Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, on the eve of Donald Trump's first State of the Union address, we discuss the mental health of our president. What began during the presidential campaign as late-night talk show fodder has become, in the words of one Republican congressman, a, quote, grave conversation about whether the president is mentally stable and fit to carry out the duties of his office. Is Trump crazy or just crazy like a fox? And does he pose a serious risk of harm to the American public? There is a so-called duty to warn movement among mental health professionals, and tonight we're joined by two contributors to a recent book entitled The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. We'll explore the heated controversy around this topic with our guests tonight and with you, our listeners. What can we truly know of Donald Trump's mental health at the distance of speeches on TV, proclamations at rallies, and 3 a.m. tweets? How much does Trump just represent the thoughts and feelings of a vocal segment of the American electorate? And if the president is deemed unfit, what can be done about it, and what might be the fallout? Joining me here in the studio tonight is Dr. Dee Mosbacher. She's a psychiatrist and Academy Award-nominated documentary filmmaker and contributor to The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, with a piece entitled, He's Got the World in His Hands and His Finger on the Trigger. Welcome, Dr. Mosbacher.
Thank you very much.
And also joining me here in the studio is Dr. Thomas Singer, psychiatrist, Jungian psychotherapist, and contributor to the same book with an article entitled Trump and the American Collective Psyche. Welcome, Dr. Singer.
Thank you.
And, of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. You can dial our toll-free number in about 20 minutes. That number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or follow us on Twitter at CityVisionsKALW. We want to hear from you and your thoughts on this question. So I'm going to start by asking how this even came about. How did the idea for a book questioning the mental stability and the mental health of our president come to be? Let's start with you, Dr. Mosbacher.
Shortly after the election, Drs. Gartrell, Herman, and myself wrote a letter to the president, President Obama, to that administration, asking that Mr. Trump receive a psychological, psychiatric evaluation because we were so concerned about some of the behaviors that we had seen in the campaign. And surprisingly, we didn't hear back from the administration, but continued to be very concerned, and we decided, we were approached by a journalist, and we decided to allow the letter to go public, and it did go public. It was published in the Huffington Post, and it went viral. We had neighbors who were visiting in India, and we heard that they were in a small town in India, and it was on the front page. The letter was on the front page of that. So we started, I think, as far as I know, we were among the first three or so people who started to speak out. And that, then many more people started to speak out. And Dr. Bandy Lee, who is our fearless leader and editor of the book you have there, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, organized a meeting at Yale to discuss this issue, to discuss the Goldwater Rule, which I can talk about a little bit later, or Dr. Singer can, to discuss the ethics of talking about Mr. Trump and raising the issue of his dangerousness.
And Dr. Singer, how did you get involved?
I got involved because I had been following Trump's primary campaign rather carefully. He terrified me very early on. And so I just started collecting things that he said and what people were saying about him. And I began to write about what I thought Trump was about and the dangers that he posed. when I heard about Bandy Lee's conference at Yale, because my emphasis was somewhat different than many of the authors, I was less concerned about Trump's individual psychopathology and more focused on what was he speaking to in the American public, what was he activating in what we Jungians call the collective psyche. So I was really interested in the interface between Trump and the group of people that he was appealing to and those people who were profoundly frightened and offended by him. So I wrote Bandy Lee because I had gone to Yale Medical School, and I introduced myself, and I said, I really would like to contribute to whatever you're doing because I have a different perspective. And she was extremely responsive, and that began my participation in this project.
So you both had concerns that came from different angles, but both concerns about the impact of the election of Donald Trump as our president. Before we sort of dive into those concerns and what you did with those concerns, just for disclosure, did you see your work as psychiatrists and mental health professionals? Did you see it as part activism? Did your politics at all impact because your decision to participate? Because I think it would be important for our listeners to know where were your motivations here?
Dr. Singer may be able to give a better sense of the gestalt, but I will say for myself, I was acting as a psychiatrist. I have had disagreements with presidents in the past, and but this time there was something that was so concerning to me. And let me just say, when we as psychiatrists evaluate somebody for dangerousness, that probably the top predictor of future violence is a history of violence. And with that in mind, we look at certain behaviors of Mr. Trump that were extremely, extremely concerning to us, such as boasting about past sexual assaults, paranoia, inability to distinguish fact from fiction, recklessness, verbal aggression, bouts of rage, lack of empathy, impulsivity, and last but not least, casual threats of the nuclear annihilation of North Korea. When I've spoken to folks about this, I ask them to tell me if they had a teenage son who constantly lied, distorted reality, used racial stereotypes, behaved aggressively, abused female classmates, bullied peers, and showed no signs of empathy, would they not march him off to a mental health provider and hope that they could fix him? Take these and other behaviors and give them to the leader of one of the most important countries in the world, and we have a recipe for disaster.
And how about you, Dr. Singer? What was beneath your
motivation? It's a very delicate, tricky, and important question, because one of the accusations that's been leveled against the book, both from the left and the right, is that it's the politicization, and I'm going to mumble that word, politicization of psychiatry, and that psychiatry should not engage in politics. It's like separation of church and state in a way. Or we've been accused of acting like the Russian psychiatrists who, I think quite inappropriately, or psychiatrists who supported Hitler. By speaking out politically, we're aligning ourselves with psychiatrists who have done that in the past. So that's been an accusation. The other issue that dovetails with that is that in our profession, as in many professions, the separation of being a professional and being a citizen is something that's really being actively reconsidered, because the fact is we are both professionals and citizens, and we try to honor our professional identity as well as being citizens. So, frankly, I was very disturbed by Trump right from the word go, but part of my and was very against Trump. I would say that that's just a fact. However, my disturbance was informed by my professional credentials, if you will, or my professional experience. I testified for Social Security and mental disability hearings for 20 years. I know the diagnostic categories really well. And so my opinions as a citizen were deeply informed by my experience as a psychiatrist. I think that's the way I would answer that. Mm.
So having said that, that kind of brings us to the next question, which is the so-called Goldwater rule, right? Which is, what is the role, if any exists, of the mental health professions, be they psychology or psychiatry, to name the two most prominent ones that come to mind. What is their role, if any, around political commentary or commenting on the fitness of a politician? So tell us a little bit more about the Goldwater rule, Dr. Bosbacher.
Well, the Goldwater rule basically states that it is unethical to provide a diagnosis for somebody, to diagnose somebody without seeing them face to face. And I think it makes sense both ethically and practically, because there's a lot that we don't know about, for instance, this president. We don't know what his past medical history is. We don't know what his laboratory results have been in the past. We don't even know what medications he's taking. So I think both practically and ethically, the Goldwater rule makes sense.
And was this, the Goldwater rule, apply only to people in the public sphere or any potential person who you might express a professional opinion about?
Anybody. That's the Goldwater rule. Now, the American Psychiatric Association took that a step further after the election. They basically prescribed against speaking at all about the mental health of an individual, period, not just diagnosing. And that we do not agree with. We believe that, at least I believe, that we have a higher duty to evaluate Mr. Trump's dangerousness, which is not based on a diagnosis. It's situational, and it's based on what is readily available to the public in terms of his tweets and his speeches and so forth.
And so how did this group, because it's 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts, decide in contributing to this book that either the Goldwater rule no longer applied or there was a way to raise your concerns and not necessarily cross that line? Dr. Singer.
Well, I think all of us felt and feel that the origins of the Goldwater rule were really important to our profession, because just to go back a bit, the Goldwater rule came about as a result of a pretty sloppy survey that was done of psychiatrists at the time that Goldwater was running. And well over 50% of the perhaps 2,000 psychiatrists that were surveyed thought that he was psychotic or schizophrenic or whatever. And it was an egregious violation of psychiatry and politics. The Goldwater rule originated because of the sloppiness of the psychiatric profession.
The sloppiness and the lawsuit that took place.
Yeah.
It always comes down to something like that. But Senator Goldwater sued this magazine that had done this survey afterwards, and he won. Mm-hmm. He sued him for libel, and he won. And sometime after that is when the American Psychiatric Association came
up. It was self-protective, but it was based on a pretty egregious violation of the use of psychiatry.
Absolutely.
I think most of us have accepted the basic principle of the Goldwater rule as being legitimate. So our task was to at least appear as if we were heeding the Goldwater rule by not diagnosing, but by focusing on symptoms without reaching a diagnosis. It's a fine line, I think, but that's what we decided because we did want to honor what we felt was legitimate in the Goldwater rule. At the same time, we felt there were so many self-evident symptoms that we could speak to, so we walked a tightrope on that one.
Would your professional credentials be at risk if you publicly crossed that line? Would the American Psychiatric Association, say something about that or take away your board certification? Or,
well, I'm no longer a member, so I don't know that they could necessarily take away my board certification. But okay.
I was always a marginal psychiatrist because I got interested in Jung, who was considered a woolly-headed mystic, and so I never did join the APA. And I consider it a pretty conservative organization. So, and they can't take away your medical license or your board certification.
Or they couldn't influence those
but
bodies that
there's
would.
A bigger question you're asking, which is what is the danger in speaking out on this issue? Because a lot of people have been bullied into silence, not just psychiatrists, but all sorts of people have been bullied into silence because of the fear of Trump's power and his willingness to go after anybody. And so it was at some great personal risk that all of us decided to speak out, I would say.
Well, just for example, Dr. Lee told us recently, she was just
Bandy,
out here.
Bandy Lee of
yes,
Yale.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. The editor of the book, Dr. Bandy Lee. Told us that she had had an encounter with a past president of the American Psychiatric Association who had somewhat of a dubious past himself, who started to tweet. They told her she should get on Twitter. She didn't start off that way, but they told her she should get on to Twitter. And he started sort of a line of Twitter, a line of conversation, mm-hmm. that basically was casting aspersions on her as a woman, mm-hmm. and as an expert, as a person. And she's somebody who's done considerable work in her field and has authored mm-hmm. textbooks and so forth. But the Trump people sort of tagged onto that to things like that ended up saying things like we should take her out before she takes him out.
Right. We actually covered this, not her case, but this topic last week. It's called trolling.
Mm-hmm. I listened to it.
That should be related.
But it mm-hmm. goes to what Dr. Singer's saying, that there was considerable concern about safety, and I think in the beginning people were very reticent to jump on board.
Yes, and she received death threats. She was receiving over 1,000 emails a day after this doctor, former head of the APA, started trolling her. And actually, this takes us right back to Trump, because he has created an atmosphere of violence and threat and abuse. That's what happens when you engage with him. You're subject to threats, bullying, violence, abuse. He's a master of that.
So I want to get into the meat of your arguments in just a moment, but first I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the mental health of Donald Trump. And in a moment, we'll question the mental milieu, let's say, of the people who elected him. Do you think it's appropriate for psychiatrists to assess the mental health of a sitting president? And what do you feel about our president's mental stability? We're joined tonight by two guests, Dr. Thomas Singer and Dr. D. Mosbacher, and they've both contributed to a recent book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which includes articles written by 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assessing the mental fitness of our president. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Dr. Mosbacher, earlier on in your comments, you kind of listed the behaviors that you were concerned about. I just scribbled them down here: boasting, paranoia, difficulty distinguishing between fact and fiction, reckless behavior, rage, impulsivity, casual threats about nuclear engagement. Did I get them all?
That's pretty close.
Okay.
Yeah.
So those were the concerns that many people have talked about over the previous year or so. And Dr. Singer, you take an interesting look at how those things may not just be just existing in a vacuum or that are specific to Donald Trump, but you see a connection between his expressions and his behaviors and something deeper within the American population. Say more about that.
Well, he actually has a certain, it turns out, political genius, because he began his campaign with an attack on political correctness. And what he was tapping into in political correctness, which really belongs more to the progressive side of our political spectrum than the conservative side, in which we advocate multiculturalism and compassion and embracing people of all, embracing everybody. So there's a, and this became known as political correctness, in the sense that you really had to be very careful about what you said about any group of people in terms of putting them down for being black or Muslim or gay or white or whatever it was.
Or female.
Yeah. Yeah, political correctness. Well, there are a large group of people, primarily, I would say, white people who sense themselves losing their grip of power in the United States. And there were profound resentments building up in this group of people. And when Trump talked about political correctness, he tapped into what, as a Jungian, I would call all the shadowy feelings that people had about having to be politically correct. They could say terrible things. They could be abusive. They could speak out about blacks. They could speak out about anybody. He gave the license. He activated a kind of level in the collective psyche of kind of rage, resentment, distrust, and fear. And he really mobilized that in an incredibly effective tool. And he did that in the context, I'll just go a little bit further with this. There's a book Christopher Hedges wrote in 2008. He called it The Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. Well, if you wanted to describe Trump and at least some of the people he's speaking to, maybe the whole culture, we are living in an empire of illusion. That's why what's fact and fiction has become so confusing. The literacy in the country is going down the drain, and the only thing that catches people's attention is the triumph of spectacle. So you've got spectacle, decrease of literacy, and confusion about fact and reality. Well, Trump's a master of all of those. He's great at spectacle. He's probably illiterate himself. I doubt if he doesn't read, apparently. And he has created an empire of illusion. So he's playing into some tendencies within the culture, not just on the right but on the left, of a kind of decline, I think.
So what you're saying, yeah, if I may paraphrase here, yeah, is that he's surfacing resentment, feelings, inner thoughts, private conversations that were just not – that didn't have a space in the public discourse. And he's good at it. So my follow-up question is, isn't that just him being politically expedient.
Well, there's another piece I'd like to add to this. Yes, he is being politically expedient, but the fact is part of his character structure is that he is what we call in psychiatry grandiose. He has a very big idea of who he is. He's a genius. What else is he? He recently told us he was both a genius and something else. He's genius and he's very stable. Well, he is a guy who has blown himself up, his own idea of himself, for decades. We call that grandiosity. My argument is that Trump's grandiosity was a natural fit with the injured, wounded sense of being big and powerful that many in this country were feeling. So if you're...
And you state white Americans here, correct? Of a certain...
I state white Americans.
Of a certain economic status, yeah. Just to be plain about
it. Yeah, mm-hmm. White Americans. He spoke to their increasing sense of powerlessness and actually no longer being the majority and a disenfranchisement, a white disenfranchisement. And what he said is that I am big and powerful, and if you and I am the American dream. I'm the incarnation of the American dream. And if you identify with me, I will make you feel big and powerful again. And that's where Trump's grandiosity dovetails perfectly with what I see as an injured narcissism in a growing white America.
For those who might not know what injured narcissism means, explain that in plain words.
Yes. Narcissism is a healthy thing, or at least a certain dose of it, where it's your own feelings about yourself and whether you're a good person or a bad person, or a valuable person or a powerful person. And what I'm arguing is that collectively I think a lot of white people have suffered in their sense of themselves and their power and their idea of who they are. And Trump really played to that perfectly.
Dr. Mosbacher, what do you make of this assessment of Dr. Singer's?
I think it makes a lot of sense. I think we also have to remember, if we look historically, I grew up in Texas, and I remember that there was a considerable number of, back then, members of the John Birch Society. And they were a far right, you might say radical right, group. And then we had the supporters of David Duke. We had the supporters of George Wallace. And that group, I think, has always stayed around 30%. Give or take a little bit. So I think there's this kernel of disgruntled people who just can't tolerate and won't tolerate other, be it race or ethnicity or gender or whatever. They can't tolerate other. And I think, in my opinion, I think there's some other folks who have been deeply, deeply distressed by the fact that they haven't made it in a world where a lot of us have been a lot more lucky.
And are looking for scapegoats.
Yes, they're looking for scapegoats, and they're looking to identify with a powerful person who promises to restore their birthright. Their American birthright as white people. Hey, that's what he promises.
Right. But I think there's another group, at least, that I feel more compassionate toward, and that is a group of people who have tried to make it and who have, over and over been laid off or, seen their wages if not go down, at least not increase. And these are people that both Republicans and Democrats have not really addressed their pain. And I think when you add into that the growing problem with opioids and the fact that for, I believe, the second year in a row, we have a declining a declining age of death, declining or an increasing death rate at an early and actually middle age, probably partially because of the opioid epidemic and so forth. You put that together, and I think there's a group of people who I think we've all missed the boat with. But I also, as I said before, I also think there's that kernel that's always been there. And, you know, not necessarily based on class or anything, but they just won't tolerate other people.
I think you make an excellent point, Dr. Mosbacher. And I think just as the Democrats lost a lot of people, lost the old Democrats in the South when when racism was challenged, and a lot of the old Democrats became Republicans but we weren't paying attention to the midsection of the country, and really where Trump won by 80,000 votes was in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin,
right,
and. This is a disenfranchised group that's seen their hopes for a better life go down the drain. And I agree with you, compassion and reaching out to them in a real way is very important. When we moved under Clinton, I remember when Clinton, we were doing all these NAFTA and all these overseas efforts, he promised to retool Americans in the Midwest with new jobs and new skills, and that never happened. These people never got hired again.
So I want to reintroduce the program again. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, and we have two contributors to that volume here with us tonight, both psychiatrists, Dr. D. Mosbacher and Dr. Thomas Singer. Again, the number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255, or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Let's go to our first caller. We got Sanjay from Fremont. Sanjay, welcome to the program.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
So my comment is I'm actually not a Trump supporter. I don't like him. I think he's going to set the country back by 10 years if he stays for 4 years, and maybe 20 years if he stays for 8 years. But I think he is not mentally crazy. So I think you have a set of doctors who are saying he's mentally crazy. I think just ridiculous. He's a bully. He's not fit to be a president. But our constitution allows us to elect anyone.
And okay. How do you make that determination? I'm curious.
I don't believe he's mentally crazy. And I think he has got policies. He knows how to manipulate the people. He has been able to manipulate the public and play on their fears. But now we even have the GOP that's supporting him. Okay, so clearly he's smart. Okay, and you know, some of his policies are crazy. Okay, I don't support him. I wish he doesn't come back after two years or so. But I don't believe he's mentally crazy. I don't think the science of psychiatry is that much of a science. I think it's very subjective. Okay, so I really think if you want to say he's not an able president, and I think you have a bunch of a varied panel to discuss that, but to have a bunch of doctors, I have heard nothing you've said which says that he's mentally crazy.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you so much.
And I think this plays to what the other side is saying, that the media is just against him.
I think
this is a ridiculous talk show.
Well, I really appreciate your call and your opinion, and we're going to dissect that a little bit more. Thanks for your call. So, you know, to Sanjay's point, as I was saying earlier, where is the line here between political craft and genius, perhaps, and madness, which is what you're asserting?
I don't think that political, if you want to call it genius, I don't think that being a genius is certainly... negates the possibility that you're mentally ill. I mean, could you call? I think there are examples of this that, you know, people who have been quite brilliant in their own way have had mental illness. And it's really not about saying, in our chapter in about the 25th Amendment, we talk about the fact that a study that was done at Duke University that looked at presidents between 1776 and 1974 found that 49% of them had symptoms that would be consistent with mental illness. And clearly, many of them served admirably. So it's not really just about it's not just really about mental illness. I don't think ever before in the history of our country have so many mental health providers come out to say that they are extremely concerned about the behavior of this president. We have the president has people who carry out his command to when he pushes the button, people have to actually carry out his nuclear commands. And they are constantly evaluated psychologically, medically, and fiscally for their ability to carry out the awesome responsibility of actually launching the missiles. But there's no such requirement for our commander-in-chief.
In fact, we have a caller who has that very question, Marnie from San Francisco. Marnie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I would like to ask the psychiatrist if they could comment on the screening evaluation that Mr. Trump received recently.
So this was by his physician, correct? Yes.
Yes, it is. Go ahead.
Who wants to take that first?
I just want to make one comment about the previous caller. Mm-hmm. If there's a 30% core of people that have been identified with the John Birch Society or other right-wing groups like that, the number of people suspicious of psychiatrists is probably 75%. Our profession lives with the kind of comment that the previous caller made, which is that what we do is
subjective.
And that's
Sanjay, not Marnie.
Sanjay. Yep. It was Sanjay. That psychiatrists don't know what they're doing. They're not experts. It's all subjective. And in fact, we've been used to being sort of the bastard child in medicine for a long time. People are much more suspicious of us than they are of Trump.
So then back to Marnie's question, which is what do you make of the screening
of that
exam?
Screen? Well,
and could you remind our listeners what the
assessment
was?
Basically, he had a physical exam, and despite multiple concerns and calls for a comprehensive neuropsychiatric exam, he was given a brief test for mild cognitive impairment, which is called the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. This is maybe better than no test, but it can be falsely reassuring. The fact that the test did not pick up the multiple concerning behaviors that are clearly visible to the public is really problematic. As I stated before, specialists and the public have noticed his inability to complete sentences, to stay with a thought, and to refrain from repetitions and tangents. His episode of slurring could be a sign of an impending stroke. In a person with a family history of dementia, poor eating habits, and infrequent exercise, a more comprehensive evaluation is warranted. Add these to the signs of dangerousness that I mentioned above, and despite the cursory exam given to the president, we continue to ask for a comprehensive medical and neuropsychiatric evaluation. And I can talk a little bit more about what we think should be included, but
okay.
That's basically.
Let's go next to George from San Francisco. George, welcome to the program.
Well, there you are. Dare we suggest that this is the discussion is drifting, and that what we are asking ourselves is whether this person is a threat as the current occupant of Oval Office. Is he a threat? Is in the neighborhood, in the politics that goes with nuclear war, which we have been trying to understand now for quite a few years, anybody who's lurking around the neighborhood, which means the planet, with a nuclear club behind his back, is somebody that we want to question. We want to ask about that person's suitability as an enforcer of the law. And if there's anything else that we were about to discuss tonight, I guess we missed it, because I felt that the discussion was going to be more pointed, and that what we should be saying is, how do we apply the law to this guy, not just to shut him up, but to get him out of there, because he's not qualified.
Well,
thanks so much, George, for your call. So that is what your article, Dr. Mosbacher, speaks to. But let me go ahead and put the number out one more time, and then we'll turn to that. excuse me. Again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the mental health of Donald Trump with our guests, Dr. Dee Mosbacher and Dr. Thomas Singer, two psychiatrists who've contributed to a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at CityVisions KALW. So back to you, Dr. Mosbacher. You talk about the 25th Amendment and how it could be used to do something about the concerns that you and Dr. Singer have raised.
Mm-hmm. The 25th Amendment deals with presidential disability and succession, and Section 4 has never been invoked to evaluate whether a sitting president is fit to serve. We are urging, in our chapter, we urge Congress to immediately act to create an independent, impartial panel of experts to evaluate whether this and all future presidents and vice presidents are medically and psychologically fit to fulfill the duties of office. And I can be more specific about what we...
So what would that entail?
Okay, well, we would like to see Congress require the nonpartisan, non-governmental National Academy of Medicine to select a panel consisting of 3 psychiatrists, 2 internists, 1 neurologist, and 1 clinical psychologist. The experts would serve 6-year terms, with 1 person rotating off each year to be replaced by a new member. Congress should require the panel to examine this and all future presidents and vice presidents annually or as needed in case of a sudden change in the medical or psychological health of the president or vice president. In addition, the legislation should require the panel to examine all future presidential and vice presidential candidates. The results of these examinations would be kept strictly confidential unless the panel determines that the physical or mental health of the president or vice president renders him or her incapable of finishing their term of office.
And does this panel's judgment, so to speak, assessment, is it binding in some way? What would happen with that assessment? Could it compel action?
No. The panel is separate from Congress. The panel would be called for by Congress, but then they would report back to Congress. The panel would have no ability. It would only be really an expert panel.
And how does this fit with what is already the mechanism laid out in the 25th Amendment?
Well, Section 4 of the 25th Amendment says that the vice president and cabinet or the vice president and Congress needs to take a step toward evaluating whether the president is fit to serve. But if Congress had already had impaneled this group of experts, then they could, the whole process would be much more timely and efficacious if the panel were already in place.
And going back to you, Dr. Singer, for a moment, the disenfranchised and demoralized segment of the electorate that voted for Trump and seems to be steadfast in their support for him, what would what would be their take of someone invoking the 25th Amendment of a panel of medical experts evaluating the current president?
Well, it would be like Sanjay's response. They would say that the panel is crazier than the president, and that it's of no value, and it's a sort of media-generated fake news story that's politically motivated to run Trump out of office. Obviously, they would protest vigorously.
And so, then I would ask you, Dr. Mosbacher, in this current political climate, not let alone what Dr. Singer just said, but in the fact that, you know, all three branches of government, well, I wouldn't say all three, but sorry, the executive branch and the Congress, excuse me, are controlled by Republicans. I'm sorry for that Freudian slip. are controlled by Republicans. How far could anything like this go? Like, how do you imagine it, you know, bumping up against or moving through partisanship?
Well, times change. I mean, I think we're hearing and not just from fire and fury, but also you know, from other leaks in the White House, that people are exceedingly concerned about the behavior of the president. So it is not without possibility that Vice President Pence could become so concerned about the mental status of the president that he actually would take this step with his cabinet, say.
And does the 25th Amendment require a specific type of assessment, or can the vice president and cabinet or Congress be use their own judgment to make?
There's leeway there, and that's why I'm saying that if Congress had impaneled such a group of experts, you know, this could be a timely and effective way to proceed. This is a way that we, you know, it could actually happen, is what we're suggesting.
I think what's more likely to happen, because I think Congress has shown itself to be so weak and unable to, except for a few exceptions, to challenge much of what Trump has done, that the most likely cause of change will be a sense of the change in the political climate, which will then give cover to Republicans who have supported Trump to move away from him. So I think the solution is probably more likely to be a political sort of collective emotion solution than a legal solution.
Well, that's what it is in the end.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, it will come back to the to Congress to act on.
Of course, the other thing is whatever Mueller finds, that's going to be really critical, because I think he's going to find some very, very damaging things about Trump, and that may create a lot of momentum of its own.
And also increase stress. I think this whole investigation has been an enormous source of stress for the president. And I think some of what we've heard coming out of the White House is based on the stress, the increased stress.
And so going back to you for a moment, Dr. Singer, how is it that you mentioned it a little bit, but just expand a little more about how our president's behavior has given such license to people to, and then what is the potential long-term effect and the risk that comes from how people act or feel able to act with impunity, perhaps, when it comes to expressing their opinions or acting out when they disagree?
Well, when the president of the United States is tweeting really nasty things about people and bullying people, this gives license to anybody who has a tendency to bully other people to do that. And apparently on the playgrounds, the American Psychological Association is reporting there's a tremendous increase of bullying on the playgrounds. What the president does and says affects people at multiple levels, including our children. And so So his bullying is one thing. His shooting from the hip, which I think was very appealing to many people because they got tired of politicians sort of dressing their points of view up in complicated statements that you couldn't tell where they stood or not. There was no question where Trump stood. I think his instinctual responses to things was very appealing to people. They like seeing somebody shoot from the hip with great emotionality. It was because it was so different than the very calm and collected way in which Obama conducted himself. So it released impulsivity and a tendency to violence in the general population. I don't think there's any question about that.
The other piece that we haven't completely touched on, although I think you gave us the gestalt, is the effect that this has had on the segment of the population, which, according to the popular vote, is a larger segment of the population that has been affected by the election of Donald Trump. And as a psychiatrist, I have heard reports from colleagues that their intake of antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication has increased. They've had been working very hard in therapy. One of the things that has been so difficult about this is that it split families apart. It has split families apart. And I think that can't be overestimated in terms of the effect on the American people. That if you have a family member who voted the exact opposite of you, it's a very, very scary thing and a disastrous thing in terms of our psyche.
Yeah, what I like to say is that Trump didn't move into the White House alone. He also moved into our psyches. And he thrives on two things that are profoundly stressful: divisiveness and chaos. He loves divisiveness and he loves chaos. And there's nothing more destabilizing for the psyche or the mental health of a population to have its leader fostering both divisiveness and chaos. It's very disruptive.
I want to get a couple of callers in before the end of the hour. We have Ron from Hercules. Welcome, Ron.
So I have to confess that I missed the beginning of the conversation where you acknowledged the rule the American Psychiatric Association put forth about needing an in-person interview. But the screener informed me that you did discuss that. So my question, though, is do you believe that that rule of an in-person interview should be waived from the Psychiatric Association's guidelines?
Thanks very much, Ron, for your call. What are your opinions here?
I mean, we did address this before, and one of the things that I said was that it makes both ethical and practical sense because there's so much of his history and medications and so forth
that we don't
know.
You're saying that in this case, but I think Ron's asking, moving forward, should the Goldwater rule be stricken from the guidelines?
No, I think it's actually fundamentally a thoughtful rule, although there are some studies now that suggest that you can learn more about a person's mental health from their public statements and their appearances on TV and radio and tweets than you can from a personal interview. So and because there's a kind of public accessibility, particularly to Trump, we probably see and hear more from him than we have from any president or probably the last 10 presidents combined. But I actually believe in the Goldwater rule.
What has been the public response of the American Psychiatric Association to this book?
Well, as I said before, there's been concern, and they've really, in essence, initiated a gag order on us. They've said, you know, they've gone way beyond the Goldwater rule and basically saying that you are not allowed to speak about any person's mental health, any public person's mental health. And, you know, it's very puzzling to me because the, you know, the American Medical Association has something like this as well. And I can't imagine the AMA saying that a pediatrician who treats kids with asthma shouldn't speak out about the quality of the air, or that we should not speak about the tainting of the water in Flint, Michigan. So it's a really a double standard in the sense that we see an imminent, dangerous psychiatric threat to our society by somebody who has a big red button at his command and says his red button is bigger than Kim Jong-un's. That is a public health threat of the highest order.
I want to get William from Belvedere in. William, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to say that I feel that the guests are, Agnew used to call, they're projecting an image of what Agnew used to call effete intellectual snobs, which are exactly the thing that Trump railed against and claimed that there was a certain class within the United States who didn't care about the average workers. And to say that the workers who voted for him, particularly in the Rust Belt states, were simply reacting to his bluster is to insult them. And they may not have college educations, but they know when they're being insulted. And I think that it's very important to recognize, at least this is my perspective, that what he said was, we're going to make America great again, which means we're going to give you jobs again. And what Hillary Clinton said, we don't have to, this is quoting her, we don't have to make America great again, we've always been great. Well, it wasn't going so great for the working class. And I think that it's important to face up to that and examine what it is about our economic system that made people vote the way they voted.
Thanks so much for your call. So, Dr. Singer, quickly, because we're almost out of time, what's your response?
Well, when you're called an effete intellectual snob, one tends to be a bit defensive, although I actually agree with the caller regarding the workers who have been deeply threatened in the Midwest, and they're not being spoken for or represented by the Democratic Party very effectively. And frankly, I think Trump's promises to those workers is about as hollow as he is blustery and overblown.
Yeah, I'm sorry if you misunderstood us, because that's exactly what we were talking about before, is a group of people who have not gotten their needs met, and the increasing gap between the rich and the poor and so forth. So I'm sorry if you missed that part or I wasn't clear about it.
So in the last minute or so of the program, where does this movement go from here, Dr. Mosbacher?
Well, we keep speaking to anybody who will listen to us. I mean, I think it's extremely important. I mean, we've got somebody in the White House who we firmly believe, and that's why we contributed to the book. Dr. Gartrell and myself contributed to the book. We believe he's very dangerous, and so we continue to speak out about that.
And I'm sorry to the callers who we weren't able to get to tonight, but I want to thank my guests, Dr. D. Mosbacher and Dr. Thomas Singer, two contributors to the volume, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, published by Thomas Dunn Books and St. Martin's Press. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. Join my co-host Ethan Elkind next Monday in a discussion of the FCC's recent repeal of net neutrality laws. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week. Music system.